My guest today, Todd Pierce, retired as major in the U.S. Army Judge Advocate General's Corps in November 2012. His most recent assignment was Defense Counsel in the Office of Chief Defense Counsel, Office of Military Commissions. In the course of that assignment, he researched and reviewed the complete records of military commissions held during the Civil War and stored at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. Shortly after my last program, my friend sent me a copy of an article by Major Pierce entitled Neocons, the Echo of German Fascism, that had appeared on Consortium News. It was long, printing out 12 pages. I ordinarily don't like reading long articles online, but this one compelled me to finish it. After doing so, I immediately set about trying to contact Todd Pierce to set up this interview because I found his article to be the most profound political analysis of the current American political scene and essential reading to understand and hopefully do something about it in our times. I reached him in Washington, where I hope to meet him this weekend. Welcome to Takes on the World, Todd Pierce.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, since the days of Richard Nixon, and for some time before that, there have been warnings about the prospects of fascism coming to the United States. But there seems to be something different and more chilling about the current political atmosphere. In your article, Neocons, the Echo of German Fascism, you seem to put your finger on it. What led you to make these connections?
Well, I'd really started working as a defense counsel, where I had to do a lot of research, as you know, both former, previous military commissions, but also to address different arguments being made by individuals. So the first article I wrote was back in 2011 on this topic, Guantanamo at 10, where I pointed out that a couple of prominent law professors, one at University of Chicago, another one at University Harvard Law School, have written extensively on why we need to go back and study the works of Carl Schmitt, the Nazi legal jurist. And so that sort of triggered my interest in what did Schmitt stand for. And in their books, they talked about why we needed a dictatorial-style government president to be, unlimited in his powers, basically, or, exactly the same as what Dick Cheney says with his unitary executive theory. And so that just began, with me doing more and more research on this and where did this originate. And I was just looking at my article, and, like one person said in a comment, something about, there we go again, going back to Hitler. But that was my point. I'm not going back to Hitler. I'm going back to the predecessor to Hitler, the conditions that were laid before Hitler came along that enabled him to come along. And it's not inevitable that there will ever be another Hitler, no matter what the conditions are. But the point is that why are we going into a different version of fascism? And that's what existed to a degree in 1920s Germany with the German military, the power that they had both, from the very beginning following World War One, and that's where Schmitt come out of. That's what he was advocating, basically a military dictatorship. So that's what began my research into this, and my father, and I pointed out in that other article, Guantanamo at 10, my father had been a survivor of the Bataan Death March, and so I sort of grew up, in a sense, understanding or reading about militarism, in that case, Japanese militarism. And militarism is really what fascism all grow out of. Requires certain different conditions and whatnot, but when they all come together, fascism results.
Well, you actually provide a number of very strong examples. We see the open declaration for more military spending, less domestic spending, and you make the comparisons with that and the fascist movement in Germany. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Well, I just heard it again, actually, or somebody's telling me, and of course, the guy who I really look to is Senator Tom Cotton, being the most closest example of fascism that I think we could see in the current American political scene, but that also includes Lindsey Graham and John McCain, all the people who are the usual suspects in advocating war. And I would include some of the Democratic Party as well. Who are always on the same side, they might want to call the war being for humanitarian purposes, but regardless, they're always for another war. Hillary Clinton, I would throw into that mix, and as some people said, in the first Clinton administration, she and Madeleine Albright had been the most militaristic of everybody in the administration. But anyway, so we have this constant, the Paul Ryan budget was all about, and actually I considered running against Michelle Bachmann before she withdrew, because I'm from Minnesota and near where her district is and could have run, just to challenge her on her statement that she repeatedly made. She'd always say, we need to cut the size of government, we've got to cut government spending, and in the same breath, she'd always say, we've got to increase spending for defense. And that's what the Republican mantra has become, whether it's Paul Ryan or even Rand Paul now. They take the one piece out of the preamble to the Constitution to provide for the common defense, and they argue that that's the only legitimate purpose for spending by the U.S. government, omitting all the rest of the preamble, which provides, says that the Constitution is to provide for the general welfare of the people, et cetera. So their emphasis on continuous increased military spending at the expense of the American people. I mean, the roads are in terrible condition. Just an article the other day in the Washington Post on increase of toll roads because there's no taxes are no longer directed toward maintaining the infrastructure, but they're directed toward Afghanistan and Iraq and all these other countries that we really don't have an interest in, shouldn't have an interest in. And that's where all of our spending is going. But it's always skimmed off. A share of that is always skimmed off by the military-industrial complex and the others who benefit by these wars. And so it's all at the expense of the American people. And what I wonder all the time is, when are the American people going to wake up to this scam that they're subject to, where this money is being stolen right out of their pockets and their children's pockets to go to the military-industrial complex, and who in turn spend a lot of money lobbying Congress for more wars, and have set up a complete network, a huge network here in Washington, D.C., of so-called think tanks to promote why we need to have another war. And that includes liberal think tanks, too, like Brookings. It's time for American people to begin waking up to what's happening to them.
Well, you make interesting exploration of the role the neocons have played in this. Your title, actually, of course, is The Neocons, the Echo of German Fascism and the Source, and how it comes together today with the election of Benjamin Netanyahu, who came from the Herut party of Menachem Begin, who is denounced, as you point out in your article, by Albert Einstein and Hannah Arendt as a fascist, and his father, Ben Zion Netanyahu, was a soulmate, actually in the same party as Begin, and was his anti-Arab racism kind of raised him were virtually the same as what the Nazis were saying about Jews. What we have is Likud was like a mirror image of what was going on in Germany. Perhaps you could talk about the importance of, as you point out, of Netanyahu being the Republicans' president.
So sort of along with writing this article, and I knew some of that beforehand, and actually a number of years ago, I looked at a book, Fighting Terrorism, by Benjamin Netanyahu, written in 1996 and then updated in 2001. And what he advises the American people is, we need to constrict our constitutional rights somewhat and realize, this is sort of written after the Oklahoma bombing. And he goes to argue that, we shouldn't allow ourselves so many constitutional rights, in essence, free speech, if it might generate hostility toward the government, et cetera. So he's advising us back in 1996 to curtail our constitutional rights. And so that's sort of what I beginning in familiar with Benjamin Netanyahu. But then I read references to what you just described before. But in writing this article, just to confirm a couple things, I did a little research, not extensive, but come up with a couple different books on the origins of the Herut Party. And there are some good books out there. One is The Road to Power, The Herut Party in Israel by Jonathan Shapiro. Another one is The Jewish Radical Right by Aaron Kaplan. And then Joseph Heller, not Catch-22 author, but a professor in Israel, wrote The Stern Gang. And they trace the roots of the Herut Party and Begin back to Poland. during the interwar years. And that was the high point, you could say, of European fascism, not just in Germany or Italy, but in Central Europe and elsewhere, France, the few sympathizers in Britain. So anyway, Begin and others who these books address came out of that Polish interwar period, where they were under the influence of the Polish prime minister and beginning there, but then also made an alliance with Mussolini and received military training, by the Irgun and the Leahy movement, the Stern Gang. So they were very much influenced and advocated. And there was disagreement, wasn't universal amongst these groups, but many of the leaders were advocating that, no, we need to be fascist, and they use that term. And again, that's where the Herut Party, that's the roots of the Herut Party. And like you say, you can hear from Nathan Yahu's own mouth, echoing what his father stood for, coming out of that very radical right wing. And we certainly saw it on display in this last election campaign by Nathan Yahu, where he sort of stripped him, took the mask off and revealed himself for what he really was. And if you read his writings, different places, like I say, Fighting Terrorism, another one is a book that he wrote back in the 1990s, A Durable Peace. And he does this with comforting words, he's obviously an artful speaker, but like in A Durable Peace, what does that mean? Well, most people think, reconciling some way with the Palestinians, giving them statehood, and, both countries being assured of secure borders, et cetera. But Nathan Yahu says in this that, in an artful way, that, we'll get a secure peace, a durable peace, when we move the Palestinian people out of the West Bank, out of the entire West Bank, Samaria
Gaza.
But and Gaza, but also, the two terms they use for the West Bank. But anyway,
Judea and Samaria.
right. And so anyway, they'll get a durable peace when the Palestinian people are moved out of there. And why would they care? Because they've got all of Jordan for themselves. Although others from this radical right wing movement over the years have also claimed parts of Jordan, as you would no doubt know. But in the immediate future, Nathan Yahu, right in the 1990s, talking about, just move them out voluntarily or forcefully into Jordan, and then we'll have a durable peace. Well, that's not a peace, a durable peace, because, anytime people are subjected to military rule, military aggression, it's natural to have a reaction back. And then that's what we're seeing right now. We have an ongoing occupation since 1967. That's merely a continuation of the war, except by a diminished level of violence. Military occupation is part of the law of war, and it's consequently, logically, it's a continuation of the war. So the war has never ended there, and I would argue whatever conditions there may have been at one time, certainly since 1990, we've had all the conditions where I don't think Israel has the same threat that they might have perceived earlier, and that's not to ignore people like Ilan Poppy, who've written that a lot of their crises that Israel had were of their own making. But in any case, here today, in my opinion, it's time for a real peace, and that means to end the military occupation, not just in form, but in substance.
When your article you mentioned, by the way, I should say, most people aren't aware today that fascism in the beginning was not a bad word. It was discussed and supported by a number of prominent people in the United States and elsewhere in Europe. So today it's a pejorative, but it wasn't at the beginning.
That's right. And I'm from Minnesota, very progressive state generally through history, not so much today, but back in the 1930s, I won't go into a long story here, but the governor, La Follette of Wisconsin, had visited Italy and came back and was telling, I think it's Floyd Olson or Elmer Benson, the governor of Minnesota, that he'd seen the future. And it was in fascist Italy. And there were a few others writing, across, both the left and the right, saying that fascism is the answer. They know how to make the country work. But obviously, you know, we saw how well they worked when they got to Stalingrad or, you know. But here's the other thing, war. And here's, you know, it's become, we really have adopted the position since 9/11 now. Here we are 14 years out from it, that we're in a long war. It's a, basically a permanent, perpetual state of war that we're in. And fascism grows out of war. If you look, you know, look at history. I mean, the interwar years, they were all about these people who've come out of the trenches of World War One, or had fought against the Bolsheviks. You know, and their attitudes, psychologically, they had been reprogrammed, you could say, to where they were hardcore militarists. And then logically, the next step was, well, how do you govern that way? And that's where fascism really grew out of. What it really grew out of. And here's the same effect I think you can see in Israel going on. Again, people first traumatized by some event, whether World War One, the Holocaust, and today, you know, although it's a much less of a event, 9/11, but there's a genuine traumatization of a lot of the American people with 9/11, you know, because it always felt so secure before that attitudes really hardened. And then, of course, we followed that up with the Iraq War. I mean, putting aside the, you know, smaller incident of Afghanistan, but the Iraq War is really what brought the Republican Party into this proto-fascist element. And it hasn't diminished in any way, but it's just grown. And I think when this idea that we're going to be in this permanent war, we need to consider the psychological effect that that has on us. And the same thing applies to Israel, you know, that they're in this permanent war. And then, of course, again, it also applies to, you know, whatever side you're talking about. So, you know, we lock ourselves in this downward spiral if we don't break this cycle of war. And there's ways to do it. We don't have to be in war. This counterterrorism, responding to terrorism does not require a state of war. That was a Bush and Cheney invention.
Well, no, I don't know if it's your article I've just read recently is we used to refer to our men in the military as soldiers, sailors, and Marines, and now they're warriors.
Right, and that too. I mean, and that's a hallmark of fascism, the elevation of the military into warriors and you know, holding them up. You can go back to Sparta, you know, ancient Sparta for that principle. And we're seeing that today. I mean, again, I'm not a career military person. I've ended up retiring as one, but it's been active duty on and off as a reservist to begin with. And I always saw myself as a citizen soldier, and that's what, you know, the American military was founded upon, being a citizen soldier, and we took an oath to defend the Constitution, not to defend the leader, not to be loyal to the leader, not even to defend the country, but to defend the Constitution, and that's been turned upside down, too. Now we're supposed to be warriors, and you get generals routinely caught talking about the warriors. You see streets named not only by military bases, but also Warrior Way, other things. I mean, I'm in D.C., so it's constant display. Last fall, we had I sympathize with victims of our wars, meaning, you know, those people who've come back serving in the military and now, you know, disabled in various ways, I think we need to treat them right. I mean, I would throw the people who were responsible in front of war crime trials, but as far as the victims, that includes the people who were misled and went into the wars and suffered physically and mentally. So certainly they should be paid tribute to for being willing to and having made sacrifices like that. But we started off there, but this last fall we had a, what was it called? Concert for Valor, I believe it was. And Bruce Springsteen and others are part of it. It was on the mall here in D.C., and a huge event, and all the military leaders were there, and everyone was there. And it wasn't about thanking people for their thanking military members for their sacrifice. We've taken another step, and now it's about celebrating their valor. And that's really getting into a fascist display of, you know, public display. Where it's again, it's you go back to all these militaristic regimes, and it's not about celebrating or thanking people anymore. Now it's about the next generation of warriors. You know, we want to push and promote their valor and imprint upon them this idea that that's the highest stage of existence, so to speak, which is fundamental to the fascist idea. And so I really found that distressful, which brings up another point, and I've been saying this for like 3 or 4 years. Where are people who used to argue for peace? And I'm thinking like Neil Young and other West Coast musicians, you know, that you would hear back in the 60s and 70s against the Vietnam War and then for peace, and they've grown silent. Here we are now, moved into another stage, more advanced stage of permanent war, and we've got silence from the, you know, people that you once were dissidents to this sort of thing. I don't mean to go on continuously, but one more thing, and one thing I've written about elsewhere is we've even put in the law now provisions for military detention of a U.S. civilian in your Section 1021 of the 2012 ND National Defense Authorization Act, provides for terrorist suspects, not terrorists, convicted terrorists, but terrorist suspects can be put into military detention pending disposition of the law of war. And the law of war, what that really means is martial law. I mean, martial law, law of war, they're equivalent as far as, governance. So we've already codified into law a provision that you'd ordinarily only see under martial law, which should be chilling to people. We now have the authority in law for the military to put somebody that they deem, only deem, suspect to be a terrorist suspect into military detention, just like four aliens are held in Guantanamo. And there's been virtually nothing coming out about that, objecting to that. So we really are in advanced state of driving toward a form of military or fascist government, whatever you want to call it.
Well, of course,
Well, one more thing I want to add is there's, you know, the counterpoint to Carl Schmitt was Ernst Fraenkel, who was a German-Jewish lawyer who left Germany in 1939 and wrote a book called The Dual State. And the very first line of it was something to the effect that the government of the Third Reich is, the law of the Third Reich is martial law. And then he goes down and shows why they were now living under a dual state. One side of the state was legally was martial law, where the Gestapo, the military, could put somebody into detention and act accordingly, follow up accordingly, the outcome never good. And then the other side was still the ordinary state, the normative state, as they called it. And that all grew out of Carl Schmitt. So Ernst Fraenkel was a counterpoint to Schmitt. But when you have Section 1021, we've reached that same condition. We've now got a dual state. In a sense, we have the normal life that we see legally, but we have this potential for military detention of U.S. citizens ongoing. And there's been a case already about it, Hedges v. Obama. It ended up being dismissed for lack of standing. But the government even acknowledged in there that under certain circumstances, they see that they have the authority to put somebody in military detention for speech alone. And that should really be chilling to the American people.
Well, you're quite right about the outrage of the lack of outrage. My guess is Todd Pierce, we're talking about an article, The Neocons, The Echo of German Fascism. I'd like you to talk about the role of the neocons and their mentor, Leo Strauss, who came from Germany, was a supporter of Carl Schmitt, but because he was Jewish, he was not allowed into the inner circles. But it seems that the neocons orchestrated the war in Iraq, you know, set up their own offices in the Pentagon, and have also orchestrated to call for chaos, which is something they said Michael Ledeen, a well-known neocon, has called for, destabilization. Perhaps you could, but talk about the Leo Strauss and the importance of the neocons in this whole setup.
So there's sort of two strands going into what's generally called the neoconservatives. One is that coming out of Irving Kristol and now down to Bill Kristol, his son, coming out of the Trotskyist movement of the before World War II and then afterwards. But the other strand is, from Strauss. Strauss wrote, and I think I don't know how much of the quote I put in there, but writing in the late 20s, early 30s, he wrote to a friend that the only objection he had to not to Germany was that he was excluded. He held up the fascist right as the ideal. So he made no secret of his fascism until he got to the United States, or he left Germany actually with the help of Carl Schmitt, your friend, and Schmitt helped him get a fellowship, Rockefeller Fellowship, I believe it might have been, or whatever, and he got out of Germany, and he ended up at the University of Chicago, where he became very influential with a number of people, including, so now we're in like a first or second generation of Straussians, but Wolfowitz and numerous others who were identified as neoconservatives and were part of the administration studied under Strauss. And Strauss had this and taught, and there's been good books written about him. I won't go too much into him, but talked about secret meanings and writings and whatnot. But fundamentally, and this sort of just struck me fairly recently, he always talked about going back to the ancients. So, but the ancients were anti-democratic, the ones you look to. Plato, we think of ancient Greece as being the birthplace of democracy, which it was. But Plato is the only, really the only voice left from there, other than, Aristotle, who's later, but Plato was anti-democratic. So when you go back there, you can find these reasons for why democracy is not a good form of government, why you need to have authority centralized in one person. You can read that in Plato, the Republic, elsewhere. So by going back, by talking about constantly going back to the ancients, and then the other thing that Strauss emphasized was the crises of modernity, meaning the Enlightenment. Those principles that came out of the Enlightenment created a crisis in life. And so we need to go back to pre-Enlightenment time. Well, that's what the fascists argued. You have to get, the first words out of Hitler's mouth, basically, when he took over was, the Enlightenment is over with. And so that's where Strauss, was teaching fascism without admitting that he was teaching fascism. But he's very influential, and it came what is known as the East Coast Straussians and the West Coast Straussians. They had some minor disagreement. And actually, I was pretty well acquainted back in the 80s with the so-called West Coast, coming out of the Claremont Institute under Harry Jaffa, who were doing some work, political work in Minnesota. So I got acquainted with some of them. And when you get to realize what they're talking about, they're sort of talking code and, Orwell's doublespeak. And until you get familiar with what they're really talking about, it might seem reasonable. But underneath it, like I say, encoded, so to speak, is really anti-democratic, fascist principles. And Johns Hopkins, for whatever reason, is very had a lot of people come out of it. But Harvey Mansfield, it's been quite a while since I really looked at this. I don't recall all the names, but certainly, I just slipped my mind now. What is the guy with Cheney? He was Wolfowitz. He was very much a central Straussian, and I would say probably the most important influence in bringing Strauss into government. And again, it's fascist at its roots, as was Strauss.
One of the things that impressed you, or depressed you, and as it did me, was the response when their hero, Netanyahu, who they had written this paper called The Clean Break, which they had advised him to break off with the Palestinians and take over, attack Iraq. It became the Project for New American Century. But the response to Netanyahu's visit, I remember in 2011, 3 days after he had publicly insulted Obama, they gave him 29 standing ovations. And I didn't count the ones they gave him this last time, but you quote Uri Avneri, the Israeli the ancient octogenarian Israeli who caught this, who was speaking about the reception that Netanyahu received here, much greater than in Israel, in fact, of course, despite his re-election. But he compared it to rallies for Hitler. Maybe talk about that.
Yeah, I think he really captured that well. And then going back to Strauss just for a second, so what they're doing in Minnesota and with think tanks and whatnot is really introducing their ideas, and they found the most receptive audience for that with the Republican Party. And so they really were able to entrench themselves in that. So they've been a long-time influence in a variety of ways with the Republican Party. And with Netanyahu, it's like they found their natural leader. He's strong, militaristic. One word that is immediately should be an immediate red flag is moral clarity. And there's a book that was written, put together, The Jerusalem Alternative, Moral Clarity for Ending the Arab-Israeli Conflict. And it's a number of, come out of any conference, but a number of the Straussians, neoconservatives, whatever they call themselves, some not all do, but Netanyahu, Frank Gaffney, Alan Keyes, Cal Thomas, Daniel Pipes, Netanyahu, Pearl. And again, the Jerusalem Alternative is that proposal of Netanyahu that, hey, there'll be no problem if only the Palestinians get out of the West Bank and maybe go a little further, and leave us in peace. That's the alternative. And as you know, Germany sort of had that same alternative. If only those people would move out of the East, get out of the way one way or another, we'll have peace. And so it was in France by submitting to our will. So it's a fascist solution to the problems that they are identifying. So Netanyahu, like I say, he by now the Republican Party, and you've seen this, you can see this in the last, since 9/11, Republican Party, who happened to have what I call a real fascist by current American terms. I mean, he's well-mannered and whatnot, but Dick Cheney, in any other historical period, I think would be have to be classified as a fascist, as they were once defined. We had the misfortune of having him near the White House when 9/11 occurred, and he put into practice the very things that they had been arguing for years. And again, it does go back to the Nixon administration, but Nixon wasn't to the same degree. But Cheney and Wolfowitz. Cheney and Rumsfeld, who came out of that period, were, they had become more and more hardened, or whatever you want to call it, hardcore, down through the Iran-Contra thing, when Cheney really put the unitary executive theory into words. And we had the misfortune of having them in power at the time. And so with 9/11, that became our Reichstag fire. It gave them cause. To argue that we got to go to war, and then, of course, it immediately expanded the war to Iraq, and just like the clean break had called for Israel to do, here we had people in power in the United States that were able to put, basically do that for Israel. But with Netanyahu coming along a few years later, I forget exactly who was there. So Netanyahu had left power at that time, but then came back after Sharon. So you had the right wing of Israel cheering on the Republicans and vice versa. And we even, here's our first experience of the real serious terrorist attack. So it's like we had no, we went fishing for what to do, and we went to Israel, seeing what they've been doing all these years as counterterrorism, when in fact what they've been doing is simply exercising occupation government, occupation law.
And state terrorism.
So we imported those practices and theories, legal theories, into our system. Again, that's where you get to Section 1021. Under military law in the occupied territories, you have, I just read a story today about a 15-year-old kid who was arrested for throwing rocks, allegedly throwing rocks, but wasn't even throwing them at anything. He was just throwing them. And again, there's far more... this is what military law means, martial law. The military commander has the authority to declare anything that he or she deems to be a hostile act, and then somebody is subject to military detention and arrest. And that can be just writing graffiti on a wall. It can be throwing rocks, even if you're not throwing it at anybody. It's all at the discretion of the military commander, dictatorship. And we've imported those ideas, legal ideas, into our system now, like say Section 1021, and then also how we're exercising military control throughout the world. The Military Commissions Act is really a martial law decree, if you stop and think about it, to the world. And that goes back, I would say, to Cheney and Wolfowitz's draft defense planning guidance of 1991, where when Cheney was Secretary of Defense, come up with the, with the Soviet Union collapse, he and Wolfowitz basically declared that now that is a winner-take-all contest, the U.S. won, now the rest of the world was subject to our military control, and we wouldn't tolerate anyone even having the ability to cause us to hesitate in our decision-making. And as others have written, that even though they had to revise that a little bit because it got leaked and objections were made, they didn't revise it in substance, and sort of became the underlying theory of some of the Clinton administration, but never fully coming to fruition until 9/11 with Cheney in office. And so the military commission's orders come along. Bush and Cheney declared the Geneva Convention is no longer applied. We could do what we want. The Republicans went along with them through the years to codify things, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. And I happened to be writing a working on a brief for somebody. And U.S. authorities, the Department of Justice and the courts have been holding for the last years that when people have brought cases against U.S. officials asking for damages for having been tortured and whatnot, the courts have routinely, and the government, Department of Justice routinely says, claims that, no, these officials are acting within the scope of their duty. Therefore, they're not subject to being sued even, let alone being prosecuted.
Extraordinary. We have unfortunately come to the end of the hour. I want to thank you so much. I'm looking forward to meeting you in Washington. Your article is online. Just Google Neocons, The Echo of German Fascism. Fascinating, frightening reading. Todd Pierce, thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. And I hope you're wrong, but right now I think you're on to something. So thanks again for opening our eyes and helping to do that.
Let me just add quickly. It's also on MondoWeiss.net under the title of Conservative Revolutionaries and Fascism, I believe.
So. Very good. Okay, thanks so much again. Take care.
Thank you.